It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the pandemic has had a big impact on the lives of women all over the country. A new survey explores the experiences of women in northeastern Wisconsin. First, President Biden was in Philadelphia yesterday with some of his strongest words so far about GOP voting restrictions that have been passed in states around the country. The speech comes after a Democratic push to overhaul elections on the federal level failed to get enough support last month, and as Democrats are looking at new ways to combat what they call voter suppression. We'll talk about that and the latest on infrastructure in our weekly look at the top stories in Washington. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about changes in voting laws being passed in states around the U.S.? Do you worry that they're restricting, maybe unfairly restricting voting rights? Or do you think we need some tighter laws in Wisconsin and elsewhere? Are there changes you want to see? Do you want to see the federal government step in and put limits on the limits that states could put in? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Francesca Chambers is the White House correspondent for McClatchy. Francesca, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
Well, I want to start with that speech from President Biden yesterday. Here's a listen to a bit of it.
There's an unfolding assault taking place in America today, an attempt to suppress and subvert the right to vote in fair and free elections, an assault on democracy, an assault on liberty, an assault on who we are as Americans.
Francesca, what stood out to you about what we heard from the president on voting rights yesterday?
Well, President Biden drew a direct line between what he referred to as the quote unquote big lie in the last election that he said that some Republicans are pushing, and that of the 2022, but both midterms, national elections. The Democrats believe that their coalition is under threat by this, the White House making that both in the president's speech, but elsewhere, a key part of their argument now. It's something that we've also heard from Vice President Kamala Harris in recent days as well. She gave a speech on this too. So both the president and vice president getting more vocal on this issue.
There's been a couple different responses. On the Republican side, Republicans are saying, hey, wait, we're making some tweaks to voting laws in states. We're making sure elections are secure and fair. Can you talk about the response to these accusations on the Republican side?
So Republicans are making the argument that they are not making it too hard for people to vote who are eligible voters, that, as you said, that they're putting reasonable restrictions on these things. And they cite polling that they say shows that many Americans support these additional restrictions. And you also have in some states like Texas, however, where even since what they originally had in the bill, they have lessened some of what was in there in order to respond to some of the critiques that are coming from Democrats, such as Democrats saying that it would be too onerous on people to say that they can't vote, you know, at certain times, whether that be weekends or later in the evening. Things like that are what are mainly under discussion at this point.
There's also been criticism from Democrats that, okay, some strong words here from Biden, but not much in the way of action. What's been the response from the left side of the Democratic Party?
Well, many progressives would like to see President Biden say that he supports either doing away with the filibuster or enacting serious reforms to it now. There's also been some sort of suggestion that perhaps you could just make an exception for voting rights when it comes to the filibuster. So there are various different ways that they would like to see him go about it, but no doubt that there is a building support for reforms or getting rid of the filibuster. And they want to see President Biden lead the charge on that because they believe that if he were to tell senators, he was a former senator, that this is his position on it, that they would listen to him as leader of the party.
There were a couple efforts, as I mentioned, to pass a couple voting rights laws. Where are they right now? Are they just dead in the water? Are they kind of on hold? What's going on?
Well, already in the U.S. Senate, one of those bills that you just referred to, it wasn't able to clear the procedural hurdle that we're referring to when we talk about the filibuster as it currently is. And Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer has said that he reserves the right to bring that legislation or any other legislation back up for a vote again. At the same time, Democrats and Republicans are trying to work on a bipartisan infrastructure bill. And of course, the president would also like to see a budget pass that includes much of his family's plan. And so the Senate certainly has its work cut out for them if they plan to leave on time for their August recess.
We're talking to Francesca Chambers, White House correspondent for McClatchy, looking at some of the top stories from the nation's capital right now, looking at voting rights, voting access, a speech from the president yesterday accusing Republicans in states around the country of infringing on voting rights. You can join in with your thoughts on that, your questions, too, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Francesca, staying with voting rights, you wrote recently that Democrats are shifting their strategy on these voting rights issues. What are you seeing?
Well, if you look at the Democratic National Committee, for instance, they're now putting $25 million towards an effort that the vice president introduced last week that they say will hope to engage voters and help to protect them in the next election. And this really does go back to what I was referring to before, that if they cannot get the kind of federal election reforms that they would like to see, then they are looking for other ways in order to protect voters, they say, including through this DNC effort. There are other outside groups that are putting money towards this as well. And the irony of it, though, is, of course, as they start to look outside Washington for ways to fix this, everyone else is looking to Washington, whether it be to President Joe Biden or whether it be to some of these senators whose minds they hope to change on voting for this legislation.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Rick is with us in Ironwood, Michigan. Rick, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Rick?
I just find that the Democrats push now towards expanding voting rights a little bit disingenuous when they start to talk about democracy, because last year they sued to get the Green Party off the ballot in several states. And it's one thing to expand voting access, which I absolutely agree with, but at the same time, if we don't have ability for anyone to run for office and expand ballot access, that's not really an expansion of democracy, I don't think.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Francesca, there's the two parties have a kind of an inside track to get onto ballots around the country. That said, on either side, whatever Republicans are advancing, whatever Democrats are advancing, it doesn't seem like ballot access has been at the center of it, unless I'm missing something.
This currently is regarding the access in terms, well, ballot access, it depends on how you define that. If we're talking about right. ballot access, if we're talking about the access of whether or not you can automatically be sent a ballot without requesting a ballot, then certainly that's part of this debate. And the Republican Party would like to see more laws in place that make sure that ballots don't get sent out to people who haven't requested absentee ballots. And they certainly would like to crack down on some of the laws that we saw during the pandemic that made it easier for people to vote remotely, vote, you know, not vote in person, that sort of thing. So it depends on, I guess, how we're defining ballot access. But the other part of what's been at the center of this debate also, and what Republicans are pointing to, is this idea of voter identification and whether or not someone should have to be able to present a government ID in order to be able to vote. That is been something that Republicans have been pushing for a long time, but it has come back around as we have these discussions as well.
Thanks for the call, Rick, at 800-642-1234. And Francesca, some drama going on with voting laws in Texas. The Democratic portion of the Texas legislature left the state, avoiding a quorum that Republicans need to pass their election changes that you mentioned a little while ago. They're in Washington, D.C. now, I believe. What's going on there?
Well, they were trying to prevent the legislature from getting a quorum in order to be able to pass through the voting law that you're referring to when they met yesterday in Washington, D.C. with Vice President Harris. But the other thing that they're trying to do is put pressure, as we talk about the filibuster, on members of the United States Senate in order to get rid of the filibuster, because there are two different tracks that you can approach this. You can take a state by state approach and try to tackle legislation that way, or you can talk about those national laws and potential voting reforms. And they would like to see those put in place in order to not have to fight this on a state by state basis.
We're talking to Francesca Chambers, White House correspondent for McClatchy. She's with us for our weekly roundup of the top stories in Washington. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Congress change how elections are run, set more federal guidelines than there currently are for states to follow? And coming up, we'll take a look at infrastructure, two tracks still running, still not done. What do you think? What do you want to see happen there? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up now our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. Francesca Chambers stays with us from McClatchy. Let's go to another caller now on the voting rights issue at 800-642-1234 with Alex in Milwaukee. Alex, hi.
Hi.
Well, what did you want to ask about, Alex?
So I'm just curious as to really how this whole process works and why it's so difficult. Like, you learn about how, you know, you're a U.S. citizen, you have the right to vote. I'm not a U.S. citizen, so I'm not super familiar with this whole process, but I'm just curious as to, like, why is this so difficult? And if, you know, all these Republicans are saying that, you know, the election was fraudulent, then what about everything else that was on the ballot?
Alex, thanks a lot for the call. I think this is a common question asked by observers from other countries, Francesca. Why things are so complicated, why rules for elections can be so different from one state to another. Why is it confusing to an outsider looking in like Alex?
Well, there are different election laws for different states, and that's part of what's under discussion here as we talk about whether there should be federal legislation. Is the federal government, some Democrats wanting the federal government to have a heavier hand in those, to make those laws more uniform? But the direction they would make them more uniform in is to expand what they see as voter access. And so that is part of the debate here, is not just about what those laws should include. It is whether or not the federal government should be taking a heavier hand in it. And Republicans would say that it should be left up to the states.
Thanks a lot for that call, Alex, at 800-642-1234. What are you watching for next, Francesca, on this voting rights debate?
Well, as we just talked about before, the Senate has much to do before their August recess, or much they'd like to do before they get to leave on their August recess. And so some civil rights leaders have said that they would like to see the Senate take this up before they leave for that recess. That's their ideal, but they understand, given the debate going on about infrastructure, if that does not happen. However, there are also people who believe that if they can't get this done now, that they don't know when they would be able to go back to voting rights this year, given that the budget process will also be coming up soon. And then, of course, next year is an election year. And in Washington, it's much tougher to get things done when an election's just around the corner.
Thanks a lot for that call, Alex, at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Patrick now in Stoughton. Patrick, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Patrick?
I wanted to bring up, isn't there part of the Fourth Amendment states that the Congress can act at any time to ensure the integrity of federal elections? I'm sure that that's not exactly the wording of it, but some are arguing that those particular sentences in the Fourth Amendment would allow the Democrats to act without the filibuster. And just have a simple majority, because the Constitution specifically says at any time. It doesn't say after, you know, a debate closing is done.
Gotcha.
What is, well, I,
Patrick, okay. Thanks for the call. And I think, Patrick, about the 14th Amendment. I think fourth is illegal search and seizure sorts of things. But I think there's been some argument out there, Francesca, pointing toward the 14th Amendment saying, hey, wait a minute. Yeah, the federal government, Congress in particular, does have more authority than they've taken, that they've assumed to regulate what goes on in states. Is that something you're hearing in actual congressional debate?
That is not currently what's at the center of the debate in Washington. That's not to say that that's not like part of the debate, but that is not currently what's at the center of the debate that's taking place in Washington right now.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Francesca Chambers from McClatchy, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Let's turn now, Francesca, to the perennial topic of this segment, infrastructure. Two tracks going on. What is the latest there?
Well, with infrastructure, it's been quite a wild ride, and that wild ride continues as we head towards that recess. The two tracks are that there's the bipartisan infrastructure deal that President Biden has signed off on with a group of Republicans and Democrats. And then there is also the legislation that is basically going to manifest itself in the way of the 2022 budget that will include many of the president's other priorities that will no longer be in the infrastructure bill, that some of which were originally in what the president wanted to deal with in infrastructure. And so the way that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has put it is without one, you can't have the other. And that's initially how the president put it, too. But he backed off of that after it seemed like it was putting that deal in jeopardy. But so long as the House Speaker says that unless there is that catch-all bill that Democrats want, that there wouldn't also be this other infrastructure legislation, then it could present problems for this deal getting done.
Let's bring on a caller now. Jim is with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi. I wanted to ask a question of your guest of the topic she just spoke about. Has she heard anything? She's more politically knowledgeable than the rest of us. Is whether Donald Trump and his allies are going to try to sabotage the bipartisan infrastructure bill by threatening Republicans with being primaried if they go along with the proposed bipartisan deal? That's my question to your guest. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks for the call. And Francesca, I think I have seen that, in fact, former President Trump has criticized Republican senators who were at least tentatively on board with this deal. What are we seeing there?
Well, what he's most concerned about, though, is Republicans who voted for his impeachment. The people that he is targeting with primaries and recruiting candidates against are the ones who voted for him to be impeached. And in some of those races, he still hasn't made endorsements yet. I've been told that he and his team are still looking at the candidates, trying to figure out who they think would be the best candidate in some of those Republican primaries. But that has been a driving factor for him in terms of whether he seeks to retaliate against these Republicans. But he also doesn't want to see, when it comes to infrastructure, he's made it quite clear that he doesn't want to see anything that would unravel the 2017 tax bill, which was arguably his signature piece of legislation, is those 2017 tax cuts.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. Francesca, let's talk about key players on each part of this infrastructure effort. First of all, the bipartisan one, trying to do it with 60 votes. Five Republicans seem squarely-ish on board. Who is out there in sort of the gray area right now?
Well, there are a couple Republicans who were even part of this original group that now say that they're concerned, and that would include Republican Senator Jerry Moran of Kansas. You also have Mike Rounds, who's part of that group as well. And part of what they're saying is not necessarily that they're not going to support it now. They want to see what's in the details. They want to see how this plays out, because it's one thing to have an agreement in part. It's another thing when ink gets put to paper and various things could change with that. They also just have listed categories of spending in this initial agreement, and those could play out when you write out the specifics in many different ways. So they would like to see what the legislative text says and potential changes that could be made through the amendment process before they give their full support to this is generally what those Republicans have been saying on Capitol Hill.
And then on the reconciliation side, the one where Democrats would go alone on all the rest of the stuff, is that a slam dunk in the Senate?
Well, all the rest of the stuff is now in question as well, because they have agreed, in principle at least, to a $3.5 trillion bill, which is not as high as some Democrats, such as Bernie Sanders, would have wanted to see. So it won't include all of the things that they had, that at least some Democrats had wanted in this particular bill, but it will include largely what the president has called his human infrastructure or the care infrastructure, things like paid family leave. That is expected to be in that bill. But the White House has also said that it will include some climate initiatives and other things like that as well. And in order, though, to get all the Democrats in the Senate to support this, as well as progressives in the House, because there's very little margin for error in the House, too, is still a very tricky line that the president is going to have to walk. And that's why he was on Capitol Hill today, meeting with some Senate Democrats at their weekly party luncheon.
Now, I dimly recall, Francesca, that Congress often steps away for a bit in August. Is there a time crunch here with that in mind?
Well, it's unclear if the intent at this point is to completely get through that 2022 budget, which is what you're referring to when we're talking about reconciliation now. It sounds like, based on what Leader Schumer has said, that there could be a scenario in which that part of it doesn't get done until later. But again, the problem with that is that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has made it clear that she wants to take the votes in tandem. And so given that situation, it could create a situation where they don't get it all done before August recess. But that is not what the White House wants to see here. And it's certainly not what most Democrats want to see happen here either.
Francesca, in just our last minute, we focused on voting rights and infrastructure. What else do you have your eye on, the big story under the radar, at least as compared to those two issues?
Well, it may not be under the radar, but it certainly isn't housed in Congress. Definitely the assassination of the Haiti president, that will have potentially a big impact on U.S. foreign policy, or at least we're learning more about President Biden's foreign policy. Of course, we also see the protests that are taking place in Cuba right now. So in addition to domestic policy, lots on the foreign policy front facing this president in this White House right now.
Francesca, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
That was Francesca Chambers. She's the White House correspondent at McClatchy. We talked to her today about the latest on infrastructure and voting rights as part of our weekly look at some of the top stories in news from Washington. A new study looks at how women in northeastern Wisconsin have experienced the COVID-19 pandemic. In a lot of ways, the pandemic has had a disproportionate impact on women. Over the course of the last year plus, women have taken on more household responsibilities than their male partners, had higher unemployment rates than men, had negative health outcomes related to stress like hypertension and increased binge drinking, and more. These impacts are felt all across the country, including in Wisconsin. We're zooming into northeastern Wisconsin now to understand what the pandemic was like for women there. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Want to hear what happened in your household? Women, how has the pandemic impacted your life in the short term and in long lasting ways? Did you deal with juggling work at home, or work at your workplace with kids suddenly not at school anymore? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Julie Keller is Executive Director of the Fox Valley Region Women's Fund. Julie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You surveyed over 1,000 women in northeastern Wisconsin earlier this year about their experiences during the pandemic. What kind of things were you looking to find out?
Yeah, we partnered with the four women's funds in northeast Wisconsin, and those are in Green Bay, Appleton, Oshkosh, and Fond du Lac. And we really wanted to see what locally was happening. We've heard a lot of the anecdotal evidence and then a lot of the national statistics, so we wanted to really narrow in on northeast Wisconsin. And we wanted to look at things like their job, how they handled childcare and school, and even things like mental health and domestic violence during this time of the pandemic. So that was the purpose of our survey.
And one of the big stories, and I touched on it briefly in the setup there, who takes responsibility when the kid's home from school and one or both parents is working, that sort of thing. What did you find out in the survey from the women you talked to?
Yeah, one of the most dramatic impacts is really that combination of the remote work coupled with, you know, your sudden loss of childcare or your children are going to school. And the survey's results showed that out of all of the family members, it was overwhelmingly the moms in the household who were responsible for that supervision of the children and the coordination of the homeschooling or online schooling. So of the women that were surveyed, 41% had children in the home enrolled in school. And then of those, two-thirds said they were the ones that primarily helped their children with their schooling or were responsible for the childcare duty. So we definitely did see an overwhelming number where it is falls on the mom in the household to do those types of duties and take care of those responsibilities.
No surprise, stress, a concern for people since the pandemic started. What kind of things did you find out from women in the survey when it came to stress and mental well-being?
Yeah, we asked about that too. And over 75% of the women surveyed said that their daily stress was moderately higher or higher during the pandemic. So a lot of women definitely faced that higher level of stress. And what I thought was interesting too is they said they expected it to drop after, you know, kind of as we're coming out of the pandemic, but they did not anticipate it to return to pre-pandemic levels. So still that kind of ongoing stress that women face even after as we're coming out now of the pandemic. And two-thirds had a major or moderate impact on their mental health. So they definitely we saw, you know, combination with working and childcare and schooling and just everything in their lives being disrupted, that it definitely increased their mental health. We also asked about ability to reach out and get the counseling or therapy they needed. And 19% said they thought they needed therapy, but they were unable to obtain it. 21% did receive counseling or therapy, and 31% actually took prescription medication during this time to deal with the mental health stressors. So we definitely saw a big impact on women's mental health during this pandemic. And it looks like it's going to be lingering afterwards as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting and kind of disturbing point. A lot of the women didn't expect to go back to whatever normal was pre-pandemic. Mm-hmm. Do you have thoughts on what we do about that, how we can help people come back to better, as good as or better than before?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. We definitely want, you know, better than before, because we know that even pre-pandemic, you know, things were not necessarily good for women. And we know that with now having more flexibility in the workplace, you know, we had to work remote. So a lot of employers now realize that this is very doable and a productive way for their employees to work. I think that will help. But I think definitely that combination of childcare, which we know is a stressor for families. Childcare is very expensive for families. It's often their highest expense, maybe, you know, as high as their mortgage. So we know that is definitely a stressor. So, you know, I think these things are still out there and things that we still need to address as we look at kind of what that new normal is and what can we learn from the pandemic and what can we make better for women and for their families.
Talking to Julie Keller with the Fox Valley Region Women's Fund, looking at a survey they did of women in northeastern Wisconsin on how the pandemic affected their lives in a lot of different ways. You could join in at 800-642-1234, maybe with your own experience. Did the pandemic make more work in your household with, say, that kid learning at home instead of at school? What was the division of labor like? If you're a single mom, well, who did you find somebody to divide that labor with? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Julie, you also asked about financial well-being in terms of income and housing expenses, mm-hmm. things like that. What stood out to you about what you heard from women?
You know, the women that answered our survey kind of fell into that more middle class, if you will. You know, the median income was over $75,000. They had bachelor's degrees. But we did find that about 19% of the women who took our survey were furloughed or laid off because of the pandemic. The good news is that they were confident in paying their rent and their mortgage and, you know, their utilities and that sort of thing. So they were in a little more of a a better economic spot to kind of weather that laid off. But we did see some of the women being laid off, but not have a huge impact on kind of their family's ability to pay your basic bills. So that was good. We also saw that children did, you know, for the women who answered this, their children did have access to technology to do the virtual schooling. You know, we know the school systems rushed, you know, to make sure we, you know, kids had Chromebooks and internet access and that sort of thing. So it looked like that was successful, at least for the women in Northeast Wisconsin who took our survey. So not as much of a financial strain for the women that took the survey, but we know that for some of the lower income women, that definitely was a challenge being laid off during this time.
You also asked women about domestic abuse and their experience during the pandemic. What kind of things did you learn?
Yeah, you know, we heard, you know, during the pandemic, the safer at home order, and we also heard that it's not necessarily to be safe at home for everybody. So somebody who's in an abusive relationship, if they're not able to get away from their home or even go to their job or have places to go or services they can access, that's really an increased stressor for women. And we did see that where abuse was already prevalent in the home, that the abuse did increase. So for instance, the number before the pandemic, 24% of women disclosed that their partner sometimes, usually, or always argued or yelled with them. And this number increased to 38% during the pandemic. Things like criticizing the things that they do, that number rose from 23% before to 41% during the pandemic. So you can see that where it was already there, it intensified. And, you know, stressors with families and losing jobs and everybody being in the same house and not having that time away or not having your support systems in place, that was really a strain for families that were experiencing domestic abuse.
Big picture, Julie, as we look at the survey as a whole, it seems like one big takeaway is for a woman listening who found the pandemic particularly stressful, maybe some solace in the idea that it wasn't just them. They're not alone, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think all women, regardless of our circumstance, found it really, really stressful, especially if you had kids, especially younger kids that really needed help with schooling, if you were worried about your job. Or just even if you had a full-time job that, you know, the expectations were still there, but you're also trying to juggle in having a child in your home who needed your attention as well as trying to do your work and all of that just really coming together, that I think it's very normal, you know, that women were stressed and had mental health issues and that it's okay to say that. And it's okay to ask for help even now. I mean, it's still a stressful time for all of us, even now, as we're trying to figure out what this new normal is going to be and how our lives are going to be going forward and what's going to happen in the fall with our kids. And, you know, there's still a lot of uncertainty. So I think just really knowing that that's okay. And it's okay to talk about that and ask for help where you need it.
Julie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Julie Keller, Executive Director of the Fox Valley Region Women's Fund, telling us about her organization's research on how the pandemic affected women in northeastern Wisconsin. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now about how the pandemic has affected the lives of women. Our next guest is Kathleen Gerson, a professor of sociology and collegiate professor of arts and science at New York University. She's the author of books including The Unfinished Revolution, Coming of Age in a New Era of Gender, Work, and Family. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 if you have questions or thoughts to share, maybe if you're a woman here in Wisconsin, on how the pandemic affected your life, your mental well-being, the work around the house, and who did it. Call 800-642-1234. Kathleen, welcome back to Central Time.
Why, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we heard about that survey of women in Northeast Wisconsin. Did that sound familiar to you from what you've seen around the country?
Extremely familiar. Very much reflects the wider trends nationally. And I think one of the more interesting findings that we're discovering is how similar these experiences were across the country, despite the fact that we think of this country as regions being so different and cities and suburbs and rural areas being so different that there really are some unifying aspects of this experience, especially for women.
An interesting thing, based on the research and work you've done in the past, I know, and you haven't been on the show before, I know that pre-pandemic wasn't this timeless era where nothing was changing. You've been following changes in gender relations for a long time. Mm-hmm. How does the pandemic, I don't know, change that course, throw a monkey wrench into things?
Very good question. Well, the first thing I would say is the pandemic, I think, did two very important things. First, it revealed a lot of patterns and challenges that American women are facing and American families are facing, including men in those families, that have been sort of under the radar and became quite clear during the pandemic. There's nothing like having the institutions you depend upon suddenly disappear to make these issues apparent in a way they weren't before. The second thing that the pandemic did was that it intensified them. Again, it made those issues even more problematic for people. And there's just no question we've been through and are continuing to go through a very intense and important period in our history, a potentially life-changing, society-changing period. And I think the real question now is, what happens next? What lessons can we learn from this experience? And are we going to take these issues more seriously now that we're so aware not only of their existence, but the depth and breadth of the ways in which they're affecting American families?
All right, you're doing your job or my job for me, Kathleen. What lessons can we learn from this experience?
Well, I think clearly what there are several lessons that I would point to. The first is the need for the America of the 20th century to take seriously the ways that family life has changed irrevocably and to address that. And that means two things. It means rethinking how we think about and go about rearing our children in this society. And that means making sure that we provide for the kind of care that they need and the kind of supports that parents need. And the second is to rethink the structure of work. And again, this has already been happening, but it's been happening without almost any attention to the ways that both work and family are connected to each other. We know the workplace is changing. The rise, for example, of remote work is not new, but certainly was intensified and exacerbated during the pandemic. The rise in the insecurity of jobs, a very similar sort of development. And we also know that women are now, especially mothers, are likely to be breadwinners as well, and we can no longer assume that women are the primary and default caretakers in normal times and in times of crisis, that they are also sharing the breadwinning and often the single breadwinners of their families. So those are the lessons the lessons that come from that recognition are fairly clear. I think what we need to do now is develop the political and social will to do the kinds of things we need to do to bring the country into the 21st century, both in terms of child rearing and in terms of the nature and structure of work.
Talking to Kathleen Gerson from New York University, sociologist there, looking at ways the pandemic affected the lives of women, changed family dynamics along the way. Kathleen, a perennial question. We've talked about it a lot here on the show over the years. In a two-parent household, a man, a woman, kids along the way, who does the stuff? You know, who cleans, who feeds the kid, who does the logistics, the planning, the school things. It tends to fall more on women. I think that gap has narrowed. But the pandemic, now, more stuff to do. What happened?
Exactly. Yes. I'll try and sum it up very quickly. But, you know, the good news is that men are and fathers are doing more. The bad news is that they're still not doing nearly as much as women, especially when you take into account that women are now likely to also be working full-time and providing essential economic support for their families. And what happened during the pandemic is very similar. And at the beginning of the pandemic, there was a lot of optimism that that it might produce more equality in the home, with both parents more likely to be there, or in some cases, a woman might be out working on site and the dad might be at home. But I'm disappointed to report that as the pandemic proceeded, several things happened. Both parents, of course, did more, no question about that. But the gender gap between what men and women did and what mothers and fathers did remained the same and in some cases widened. I think one of the more surprising findings for me is that when schooling moved into the home, this actually increased inequality. I would have anticipated, especially because schooling is something that clearly both mothers and fathers can help their children with. It's not really the kind of thing that we think of as associated with one gender or the other. And yet, mothers took on most of that schooling. Fathers were less likely to be involved. But I don't think we should jump to the conclusion that this is somehow bad faith on the part of dads. I would rather point to the pressures at work. We know that women, for example, were more likely to lose their jobs, to pull back in terms of the hours they put into work than men. And men were, not surprisingly, likely to feel a great deal of pressure to hold on to their jobs and to prove that they were committed workers, even when the nature of the work had changed. And so rather than just focusing, I think, on what happens within the family, it's important for us as a nation to see what are the other forces at work that impinge on families and make it difficult for them to develop the kinds of practices that they would like to have. Survey after survey shows that, in fact, fathers want to be involved with their children, and couples say they want more egalitarian sharing, and they continue to face a lot of obstacles. And in some sense, the pandemic made those obstacles even greater, and the sense of insecurity about what needed to be done even greater. Both.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Kathleen Gerson, who I hope we'll have back to talk more about these issues, professor of sociology at New York University, author of the book, The Unfinished Revolution, Coming of Age in a New Era of Gender, Work, and Family. She joined us to talk about how the pandemic has affected gender equality in the home.